Welcome to The Leading Tone, a podcast that explores all aspects of all types of music. I'm Fernando.
And I'm Alex, and welcome to The Leading Tone podcast. We're excited to share with you our 10th weekly episode of the podcast. Thank all of you for the great support, and be sure to stick with us each Monday for more on all kinds of music. Today, we're excited to bring you a new type of show, today discussing one of Georges Bizet's hidden orchestral gems, Roma. But before we get into that, let's guess that lick.
Guess that lick or don't miss the prize.
Welcome to Guess That Lick, our weekly quiz show that tests our musical memory. Each of us will bring an isolated excerpt of music, either from a recording or just a piano track recording, and the other co-host will have three listens to Guess That Lick. For a maximum of 5 points per episode, here's the scoring breakdown. Get 1 point for each of the following: the piece, the movement, the composer, the time period, and the genre. Without further ado, let's get into it. So last week, I guessed a lick prepared by Fernando. It was Shostakovich's Ninth Symphony, the third movement. That was a fun one, and I nearly didn't get it, but I did scrape away with 4 out of the 5 points, just barely.
Yeah.
So this week, I have brought a lick for Fernando, and I think that he'll probably be able to get this one. It's a good one, though.
All right, we'll see.
All right, well, here is your first listen. That was your first listen. Any guesses?
No, I've got no guesses right now from, like, right off the top. I am not sure exactly what this is, so.
Really?
It doesn't sound super familiar, but I can probably nail down some of these categories, maybe. We'll see.
Well, do you want another listen before you?
Yeah, I think I'll take one more listen before I get into guessing.
All right, here we go. That was your second listen.
Man, you stumped me again. This was a hard one.
It's a tough one?
Yeah.
Let's start with genre and time period, probably.
It's tough with the piano recording like that, too.
Yeah, well, I think if you heard the instrumental version of this, you would get it instantly.
Maybe.
And I will give you a little bit of a hint. It is from the beginning of a movement.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
What conclusions would you draw from the context of the melody? This does not, what time period would you link this with?
Okay, this is the melody and the bass line? Is that what the reduction
this
is?
This is the only thing that is going
on. Only thing that's going on.
This is the only thing that is going on. There's nothing else going on in this piece at this moment. It's only three instruments playing.
Okay. All right, I'll take the final listen, and then I can...
All right.
I'll be it. Okay, yeah, that does give me a bit more of a hint. I wasn't really feeling the pulse there.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to guess with my time period guess. I'm going to go with 20th century.
You would be correct.
Yeah, we got some odd meters. The time period.
The time period.
And the genre I'm still working on. I guess I'll have to guess, like, a symphony. I guess it could be...
You would be correct.
Okay, yeah.
You would be correct that it is a symphony.
Okay, so it's a symphony, and it's... I'll go with the second movement, then.
Okay. Well, the second movement would be correct.
Okay.
So you have remaining the piece and the composer.
Composers that were doing odd meters and writing symphonies in the 20th century. There's a few, but Bernstein is an option.
Well, who's your guess?
I'm going to go with Bernstein as my
That
final
would be
answer.
Correct.
Okay.
That would be correct. And
we got there eventually.
Are you going to guess the piece? The piece?
Okay, so he's got a couple symphonies. I'll go with the Jeremiah Symphony.
And that would be correct.
Yeah.
So this is Leonard Bernstein's Jeremiah Symphony, his first symphony written in 1942. The second movement, Profanation, in the 20th century, of course. That leaves Fernando with 10 points total. I knew with the instrumentation of this work that if only you heard the flute and the low clarinet and the piccolo, you would have gotten it instantly. But brought into the piano context,
it totally changes it.
Yeah, yeah. And well, I did it in a, I was thinking similarly to how you thought last week with the Shostakovich. Yeah. I was just like, what is something similar to that? Because I was stumped in the same way. I thought it was the strings, not the woodwinds. Right. And I was just like, okay, this is a piece Fernando knows for sure. And I know we've talked about this piece. Yeah. So I was like, okay, this kind of points you in a couple of different directions. It's similar to how I thought the Shostakovich was Britain last week. Because I was just like, oh, this totally sounds like something from the Young Person's Guide. It's deceiving with the piano track. But so here is the current leaderboard for Guess That Lick. Fernando is in the lead with 10 points. He's been 5 for 5 both weeks. And then I am trailing behind, though I have only done 1 week of this with 4 points.
Right.
So hopefully next week I can start to make some ground and catch up.
Keep
to
up.
Fernando.
Yeah. I think you'll keep up.
Well, we hope you all had fun trying to guess that lick with us. Let's go ahead and move on to our next segment, What's New in Music?
Welcome to What's New in Music, where we detail the latest happenings in the music world, from new albums in every genre to our own experiences in listening. Now, our headlines today are that the Chicago Symphony announced that they're going to be releasing a new podcast. It's called Intermission at the CSO. It's going to have a lot of interviews with the musicians of the CSO, and it kind of gives you this behind-the-scenes feel for what they're doing over there in Chicago, which is really cool.
And it's something different from what we're doing here, so we thought it'd be great to mention that another great music podcast is being released.
Also this week was the announcement of the Kane Masons. You might be familiar with Sheku Kane Mason or Isata Kane Mason. Their family is releasing an album soon in November, November 6th specifically, which will have Saint-Saëns' Carnival of the Animals, poetry by Michael Morpurgo, and the reading of the poetry by actor Olivia Colman.
I think it's really interesting, the Carnival of the Animals that we just listened to last week. I think it's really cool that they're doing that cover of it. And so Kane Mason, he's a cello player, right?
Sheku Kane Mason.
Sheku is a cello player.
Right, he's a cellist, and he's pretty well known. Definitely has some great recordings out there, so check those out. And also, when this album comes out in November, make sure to check that out as well. There's actually a little preview. They have the aquarium from Carnival of the Animals is already released, so you can hear what that's going to be sounding like. Unfortunately, that one doesn't have the poetry and narration yet, but I think once it all comes together, it's going to be really a cool project that we'll get to hear.
Yeah, it's still a great performance, too. So definitely check it out on Spotify.
And we've got some other notable albums and releases from this past week. Thelonious Monk, you might know him in the jazz world.
Yeah.
He's not still around, but he did have an album release this week. He performed in Palo Alto at the Palo Alto High School in California 52 years ago. And a recording has just resurfaced now.
So cool.
Yeah, and now we get to hear it. So it has been released from the guy that organized the event way back in the day, one of the students that had organized the event. He brought the recording to the attention of the Monk family and said, hey, I have this recording. Do you guys want to release it? And they decided to do it.
That's so cool. Can you imagine being a high schooler and on some random Sunday, Thelonious Monk, it just comes in and plays at your high school? I mean, goodness. That would be the best.
We've also got Alicia Keys' new album, which released this past Friday. It was called Alicia, and that one is a really fun kind of, you know, hip-hop, R&B, kind of a fusion of a lot of genres.
Curious opening to that very first track there with the orchestra sounds.
Yeah, there's some string sounds intermixed throughout there, so that one's a really fun one for those lovers of a little bit more of a popular or R&B kind of sound. And then we've also got Butcher Brown with his new album, Hashtag King Butch. That one's a little bit more of a jazzy, hip-hop, funk-type album, and I thought that one was really fun, very different.
Very cool, yeah.
Yeah, so that one's got a lot of influences in its own right as well. That one's a really fun one. Butcher Brown's Hashtag King Butch, Alicia Keys' Alicia, and the Thelonious Monk album and recording from Palo Alto High School.
Yeah, definitely check out all of those. Now, Fernando, what's going on in our musical lives this week?
Well, nothing too crazy. I did a lot of listening this week. I've listened through the album, the 2018 album, The Nature of Imitation by Dorian Concept, and it's really a really fun electronic jazz mixture. I really like that one. I've also watched and listened to a few interviews and lectures from Morton Feldman, who was a 20th century composer from the U.S., a true New Yorker, so that one, it's fun to hear him talk sometimes. He's got some really interesting perspectives. Also listened to some Leroy Anderson, his Irish Suite, Mendelssohn's Third Symphony, and some wind band pieces by Norman Delajoyo, Scenes from the Louvre, and Variants on a Medieval Tune. Those are both some wind band pieces by Delajoyo that I like, and all of those pieces are just some that came up in my rotation.
Yeah, that's some really, really great listening and a lot of variety. The Morton Feldman was really, really cool. You showed me some clips from that, and he seemed like a really great educator and had a cool perspective on music. So definitely interesting there. As for me, like we talked about last week, Vincent Persichetti, I've been listening to a lot of his music, particularly his Symphony No. 6 for band and Divertimento. I don't know if I've said this on the podcast, but I am actually picking up a secondary instrument this semester in graduate school, the clarinet. I'm a trumpet player. Both of us are trumpet players, but I've been listening to some potential pieces to maybe play for my final jury this semester. Fauré's Après un rêve and Ray Vaughan Williams' Six Studies in English Folk Song. So definitely hitting the ground running with that and just trying to be as well-rounded of a musician as I can be.
Yeah, great music to start, you know, on a new instrument.
Yeah, so. I was really, really excited when my teacher presented these to me, and I was like, oh, these are two composers that I really, really love.
So yeah,
was,
some of our favorite, they're on our list.
Yeah, they're on our top 100 list. If you haven't listened to our most recent edition this past week, go ahead and check out our third edition of Top 100 Composers.
Definitely haven't gotten to Fauré yet. But
no, yeah, we haven't. We have talked about Vaughan Williams. Not too much longer until we get to Fauré, I don't think.
Right.
Some other French music, Bizet, who we'll be talking about pretty extensively today, his Roma, as well as his Carmen suites, and then Debussy, a lot of music by Debussy I've been listening to. And I've been listening to this album of Samuel Barber's choral music. We talked about that last week as well. This album is called Barber, an American Romantic. Goodness, this music is just so heart-wrenching and so beautiful, and I've really, really enjoyed that on my commutes to and from work this week.
I've been listening to some Barber choral music too, and it's really,
really,
yeah, it's very, very moving a lot of times, and it's really fun to also listen to choral music in general because it's a good change of pace, and then also
especially for us,
right, right, for us as instrumentalists, it's a good change of pace.
And weirdly, I've been listening to a lot of marches this week. It just so happened to come up in my rotation. Barber's Commando March is one of my favorites, and then
one of my favorites as well.
Yeah, it's so good. I really want to listen to that on the podcast at some point. Then Waterer's Gibraltar March, which I played a few years ago and was a huge fan of that. It sounds a lot like some of John Williams' music from Star Wars. The that Force theme that pops up a lot. There's one theme in there that really reminds me of that. But it's in this March setting, so it's really cool and interesting. So that's one that I've listened to quite a few times this week, actually. So I think without any further ado, let's go ahead and get into today's topic. So this series, you see by the episode title, we call it Hidden Gems. And we wanted to present something to the audience where we listen to works that are not really explicitly known or performed that often, and just kind of hide in plain sight in the repertoire a little bit. And this is one of them. So this is Georges Bizet's Roma that we're going to be talking about today. A little bit about Bizet, a French romantic composer, lived from 1838 to 1875. He passed away at age 36. But despite this, he gave us some of the greatest French romantic music. Before we get into our hidden gem for today, let's listen to something by Bizet that's likely very familiar to you. Let's listen to an excerpt of Bizet's famous Carmen. Let's take a listen.
Mm-hmm.
was Bizet's Carmen, the habanera from Act One. And if you haven't heard this, you're probably living under a rock, because I feel like that I heard this all throughout my life, throughout my childhood, and into, of course, what orchestra and orchestral realm. This is such a staple. And this was one of Bizet's final masterpieces, actually. It was premiered in 1875, the year of his death. And it's a four-act opera, and today we listen to an excerpt from Act One. Yeah, and the Habanero and the Toreador song are among some of the most recognizable works written for opera and for the orchestra. They're frequently used in media. We just felt that rather than talking so much about Bizet at first, I think that his music kind of speaks for itself.
Right, yeah. And, you know, you might not be familiar with the name, but you're probably familiar with the music, so we wanted to give you a little bit of that. So, with that being said, now let's talk about a little bit more of who Bizet was and a little bit of his biographical information.
Right, so both of his parents were musical, actually, and his father was a composer. Not a particularly well-regarded composer, not really shown any favor in the eyes of history. But his mother, who Bizet was influenced by quite a bit, taught him how to read music and taught him his initial piano lessons. Then he enrolls in the Paris Conservatory at age 9. He won many prizes in his 9 years at the conservatory. He actually won the Prix de Rome, which we've talked about before on the podcast with Ravel a couple episodes ago, and he won that for a musical composition in 1857. During this time is when his maturity as a composer is really skyrocketing, and his first catalog works are a couple of piano works and some songs, but he becomes more well-known for his opera, and he writes his first one in 1855, La Maison du Docteur, and a lot of Bizet's income actually came from his arranging career, not his operatic career at the time. He was arranging a lot of works of the great French composers at the time that were really big, because composers like Gounod were bigger than Bizet in his lifetime. But it's just so funny how the eyes of history really favor Bizet and his great work with Carmen particularly, and then Gounod has kind of shifted down quite a bit in relevance. So his Symphony in C is the earliest work that Bizet wrote that is still performed today, though it was not performed until 1935. This actually was written when Bizet was 17, and this work was a really, really great romantic symphony that Fernando and I both really, really enjoy, and has some great melodies in it.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. Very melodic and very just fun. Right?
Yeah.
It just has a lightness to it that is really enjoyable, and it's a good one for just in casual listening.
Absolutely, yeah. It's great to jump in. So his Symphony in C is his only symphony that's recognized by the eyes of history. However, he spent 3 years in Italy, where he starts to become privy to the music of Rossini, enjoys the Italian landscape, drinks wine, appreciates art, Italian music and opera, and he has the opportunity to, most importantly, be productive or maybe a little bit lazy at his own whim.
Right, he could take a wine drinking day every now and then.
Yeah, and so this leads us to our topic today. Based off of his time in Italy, he begins planning a four-movement symphony based off of Italy, which over the course of 11 years and a lot of revisions becomes the work we know today as Roma. And that is the work that we'll be discussing today. So without further ado, let's show you our first hidden gem of our hidden gem series. This is the first movement of Roma, the Andante Tranquillo, and this is an excerpt from Towards the End. Let's take a listen.
Thank you.
That was the first movement of Roma, Andante Tranquillo, from Bizet's Roma. Bizet said of this first movement that it bears no resemblance to any known first movement. It is new, and I count on a good effect.
And I think it's funny because we discussed how, like, this kind of mid early romantic period in symphonies, there is less variance, but I feel like that this is really truly unique amongst this era of romantic symphonies in particular, and especially in France.
Oh, definitely. And you see the most growth in this period of time, you know, in the romantic period, you're seeing a lot of growth in a lot of different directions,
right?
With music, and particularly in this earlier middle romantic period, you're really getting into where people are going to start moving in certain directions with their music.
And right.
I think, yeah, very clear with this one, with Bizet. This is also the movement that is allegedly based on Rome.
Yeah, so each one of these movements, he actually has a different Italian city that he is basing each movement on. He wrote in another letter, "I have a symphony in mind which I should like to call Rome, Venice, Florence, and Naples. That works out wonderfully. Venice would be my andante, Rome my first movement, Florence my scherzo, and Naples my finale. It's a new idea, I think."
I just love how he adds the "I think" at the end.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it might be a new idea, but
it gives you a little insight into his personality a little bit
too. Right. And I always appreciate that. I think that's one of our big goals, to kind of contextualize
these composers. Yeah, to humanize this, because, I mean, these were people.
Seemingly fun people, so.
And so there is definitely some inspiration from Weber's Der Freischütz at the beginning here, with the four horns playing this beautiful melody. I just love that so much, and it struck me so much upon my first listening. In fact, last week was the first time I listened to this work, and it struck me so much. I was like, whoa, hold on, why does nobody talk about this piece? This
right.
is great.
Right, and one of the biggest things with that is also just the melodies in this piece, and right. in all of Bizet's writing. You see it in Carmen, you see it in L'Arlesson, you see it in all of these other works by Bizet, and it's always the same. These are the tunes that I'm always whistling and humming around the house, and they come up a lot just in my head. They're earworms, right?
Yeah.
And this is this first movement is no exception. There's some great melodies in this first movement and throughout this whole work. With that being said, though, I think we can hear a little bit more of the a little bit faster paced Allegro agitato.
Yeah.
The middle of the first movement. We're backtracking just a little bit. So this is still the first movement of Roma, Allegro agitato. Let's take a listen.
Thank you.
was another excerpt from the first movement of Roma. This is the Allegro Agitato section. This sounds so much like Tchaikovsky.
Yeah, it does. It sounds like a lot of other composers in this time period.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really just, it has this energy to it. I mean, Allegro Agitato is one way of describing it, but right. I think it has a much more powerful and much more stately kind of effect to it as well. As well as just being agitated,
right.
As the direct translation would be.
Yeah, and I think some of these like fanfarish statements in particular take me back to Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony, one of my favorite works, so mm-hmm. explains why this work is connecting with me so right. much.
And it was also, I had related it earlier to Lalo.
Yeah!
And another French
Edouard
composer.
Lalo.
That was another one where I was like, you know, this is another French composer, also in the Romantic period, that was writing similar music, but... He's for another day, I suppose.
Another hidden gem, because most people listening to this podcast probably have not heard of Lalo.
Right. So. Yeah, Edward Lalo.
If you have, then yeah, you've heard some great music. I just love so much the transitional writing here. We played the beginning of the transition into the section, but the flurry of string notes, it's so virtuosic, and I love in this recording how well performed that is, and it gets fast. Those triplet figures, I mean, it's crazy. And goodness, if Bizet had written more symphonies, I can't imagine what he would have given us, because this is great. This sounds like mature symphonic writing that he's written like six other romantic symphonies.
Right, but, very different from his first symphony.
Right, so this is his second attempt at the symphonies, mm-hmm. and I find it so interesting how mature this really sounds. Let's take a listen to another excerpt from this movement. This is the Scherzo Allegretto Vivace, and this is actually the only part of the work to remain consistent on his 11 years working on this masterpiece. Let's take a listen to the Scherzo from Roma.
Thank you. That was the second movement of Roma by Bizet. And this one's a little bit more lively, as the title would suggest, the tempo marking would suggest, with Allegretto Vivace.
Oh, yeah. But equally as melodic and catchy, I love how this starts, but then about 2 minutes in, where it starts to diminuendo a little bit, and that gorgeous melody just blooms out of nowhere. It's like, what? How come nobody talks about this work? I'm going to keep saying that, because this is really such a masterpiece.
Yeah, and in that second part that you're talking about, that string part, it almost sounds like Elgar, too. Yeah. And that is such an interesting comparison in my head. Yeah. But it has that similar theme to the Enigma variations.
Right, so we talked about Elgar before on the podcast, but I would never think to relate Elgar and Bizet in any way, shape, or form. But then when you said that, I was like, maybe there's some more similarities between their music than I would really initially think.
Right.
So that got me thinking a little bit.
But this was not inspired by any British music or anything like that.
No, in fact, it was inspired by the city of Florence in Italy, supposedly. After leaving Rome, he completed this movement based on Florence, and this was actually performed in 1863. Camille Saint-Saëns was in the audience, and it was not very well received. It was apparently very poorly performed by the orchestra, and the audience got in a bit of a fervor about it. Subsequent performances improved and were given greater reception, and people started to like this movement a little bit more. It's interesting because almost all the scholarship that I read for this says that, like, this is unquestionably the best movement of this work, and I don't know if I agree. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
It's great, but we're about to show you some of these other movements that I think are equally as great, but this is one of the most well-regarded movements.
It is really interesting that the second movement has been the one that most people keep referencing, probably just because they don't listen through the whole thing, or maybe they just don't listen as carefully. I don't know, but It's strange that this one is so well recognized and the other ones kind of fall by the wayside.
It's the fast movement syndrome. It's like, oh, I only listen to the fast movement.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well,
I really do think that that's part of it, because they're looking for something exciting and fast and romantic, and then the beginning of the first movement, they're like, oh, this is
and I can,
this is boring.
Yeah, and I can see where they might come from with this movement being very cohesive and formally correct. It has very distinct sections, and it's very clear.
This is the romantic period, people. Like, not everything is as it should be in the classical period. This is a time of market change in music.
And, right.
And should be.
And that's why this work is so special, too, because I think it is a good indicator of where music was going at the time.
Right. And maybe wise in retrospect, some people are looking at it as kind of an anomaly in history, but really it's just a great example of great romantic essence writing.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit more about the process behind this piece. So I said that this part of the piece was performed in 1863. He had finished that, but in 1866 he completes the first draft of the whole Roma Symphony, symphonic suite, if you will. And this was a theme in variations, and this version has been lost to history. We don't know what it sounds like. He ended up scrapping it, though. He did not like it very much. The next version was in 1868. It premiered as Fantaisie Symphonique, Souvenir de Rome. And Bizet was also dissatisfied with this one, and revisions continued. This finished version is from 1873, but it was not performed until after Bizet's death in 1875. So now we're going to take a listen to the third movement of Roma, the Andante Molto. And this is a little bit later in the work, but we're going to show you how expressive Bizet can really be with some of these melodies. Let's take a listen to the third movement of Roma. Thank you. was an excerpt from Movement 3 of Roma, Andante Molto. What a great work. And we were just remarking about how Bizet is so good about bringing in these great unexpected string pickups with these really, really lush melodies. He does that throughout this work, and it's kind of this recurring thing. We talked about that with the scherzo, but he also does it here, and it just takes the breath out of you. It just is so engaging and almost film score like in quality a little bit.
Absolutely, that's what I was thinking the most. It has this film score quality, but then the trumpet kind of has a fanfare, and it brings you back. Yeah. It brings you back to this romantic period style, and that's what's so great about this work. And yeah. I love the emotion in this work. This one kind of tugs at my heartstrings. I don't know what it is, but it's just so expressive, I guess.
Well, it's based off the city of Venice, which is known for being a city of romance and great intrigue. So I think that he nailed it here. I can picture the canals at night and the lighting. I love it. It's great. Mahler was actually a big fan of this work, and he premiered it in Vienna and America on tours there. And you could definitely hear some of Mahler's love for this work in his Fifth Symphony, the Adagietto. They are remarkably similar in how they open up. You should take a listen to the opening of this movie. Even some of the excerpts that we played for you today are remarkably similar to that Mahler excerpt. So, some other interesting facts about this piece. While Bizet classifies this work as a symphony in many sources, many consider it actually to be more of a symphonic suite. I think that's interesting because it's very clearly a symphony to me and was meant to be a symphony, and he wrote it as a symphony, but it's often mislabeled as a suite in a lot of different contexts. The history behind this piece is so interesting to both of us because it's not very well documented, and what we do know about it is kind of hearsay. Mm-hmm. There's evidence from some letters, but then there's things from publishers and different editors that got a hold of this. So it's interesting because there are technically a couple different ways you can categorize this work.
Right. And just the music of the Romantic period in general, it's so hard to categorize a lot of the works because they're starting to move to this programmatic style,
right,
that breaks the forms that they work so hard to establish in the classical period.
Yes.
And so this is a programmatic work in a lot of ways because it's based on these cities and it's trying to paint a picture of these cities in each different movement.
Right.
But there still is this overarching form that is symphonic, and that's why there is that argument: is it a symphony, is it not, is this a symphonic suite? And you know, I can see both sides, and that's just how the classifications and genres of the Romantic period work. It's very hard to classify any of these works, and I think that that's one of the most interesting things about the Romantic period, and that's why we have the music that we have today too. So
absolutely, yeah, I couldn't have put it better myself. I think that that's a great analysis, Fernando. I think overall this work is just this beautiful patchwork quilt. It was actually rumored to be a couple of different pieces that he kind of put together, ideas that he had, because he had two other symphonies that he started the draft in the late 1850s that he did away with. He scrapped. He said he destroyed them, actually, because he didn't like them. But because the process of this work was so long, there was a couple of different variations of this work throughout its history. So it ended up just becoming this beautiful masterpiece. And speaking of masterpiece, let's listen to the fourth movement now. This is the fourth movement of Roma, Allegro Vivacissimo, also subtitled Carnival in a lot of instances. So let's take a listen. was an excerpt from Movement 4 of Roma, Allegro Vivacissimo, Carnival, subtitled. So it's actually funny because Bizet did not think that this was up to standard with the rest of the work. Yeah, this is actually one of the more well-regarded movements of this work.
Yeah, I think I read that this one gets performed as a standalone as
it
well.
It does, yeah. Much more frequently than this whole work gets performed. There's a couple of albums, actually, that just have the Carnival movement, the fourth movement.
Right, and I understand why. It's a very catchy tarantella, kind of inspired by the music of Naples, and it's a really fun one. I understand why this one gets performed so often, but the rest of this work is also just so fantastic.
Does it not remind you of Mendelssohn's Italian?
Yeah, it kind of does.
Yeah, I think that was,
well, particularly it reminds me of Rossini. I think
Rossini's well. Music, and that's great to bring up because Bizet loved Rossini. And he loved Rossini, and he loved Mendelssohn and Mozart and Gounod in particular. I think that those were all such huge influences. Something I love about this excerpt in particular, that string pickup that we loved in the previous listening, he brings that back within the first 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. He's just, oh yeah, remember this great thing I did? I'm going to do it in this great unexpected way in the middle of this this fast driving, almost kind of dance like Italian sound.
Mm-hmm.
I love it so much.
Yeah,
and it just keeps giving me more of what I love of the Romantic Symphony in particular. Just these great lush melodies, and interspersed with just really masterful orchestration. The orchestration in all of Bizet's music is just brilliant. It's mm-hmm. so well done. He has such an understanding of each instrument family. In particular, I think the string section, but the wind section, the wind use is very clever here with the flute dance-like motif over top, because there's like the pizzicato stuff.
Right, and the oboe that comes in. Buddy.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, that it reminds me of that Dudamel video of him conducting the Mendelssohn.
Mm-hmm.
anyway. So a little bit more about the work itself. We have mentioned that this is intended to be his second symphony. However, since his symphony in C, his first symphony, had not been premiered until much later after his passing, I think that that's part of the reason why the storyline of this work is so confused, is because he didn't know what to really release it as, because he's like, well, I never had my first symphony even performed.
Mm-hmm.
So that is worth mentioning there. Bizet actually went back and forth with his confidence in this work. He told Camille Saint-Saëns that he is nothing without the theater and not made for the symphony. But yet in other letters, he refers to this work with great confidence, saying many times that the work was finished when it actually wasn't. And then he refers it as his symphony, my symphony, in quotes. So I think that he had a really personal connection, obviously, because he loved his time in Italy so much. And that's why that this work has so much passion overflowing, because it really is truly his work and encapsulates this part of his life. It seemed like it brought him great joy. And so 5 years after its performance as Roma, it's actually published as Roma Symphony in Four Parts. So it is, its original publishing refers to it as a symphony. So it further kind of confirms our case that this is very much Bizet's second symphony here. We talked about the influences of Bizet. I think Mendelssohn, Gounod, Rossini, and Mozart probably brought a lot of the influence this work. And you can definitely hear it, as well as Tchaikovsky, we've mentioned. I don't think that was over. I think that just so happened, because that's a sound that we both definitely assume when we talk about the Romantic period.
Well, if you like any of the composers that we just mentioned, or the influences that Bizet might have had for this work, then you'll probably like the rest of this whole work. And we really highly recommend this work to listen through the whole thing, because we both love it and we've been listening through this throughout the week. It's just a remarkable work.
I'm just so glad that we got the focus on one work for this episode and really dive deep into it, because it's really, I think it is really special that we get to listen to so much of this on the show, mm-hmm. because this is such a unsung masterpiece of the Romantic period.
Right. And it's just such a fun work. I really, really enjoyed talking about it and listening through it. It's always a good time with Bizet.
And this is
so
my,
melodic and so, yeah.
This is my week anniversary of having listened to this piece for the first time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because you showed it to me.
Yeah, I found this work a while ago. I was very into Bizet and French Romanticism in general a couple of years ago. And so, yeah, this one I've known for a while, and that's why I've always thought it was a hidden gem as well.
Yeah, so we hope you enjoyed our deep dive on this hidden gem of the orchestral repertoire. And who knows, maybe one day it'll become as often performed as his symphony in C, or, well, it probably won't be as much as Carmen, because Carmen's like the most performed work in the world. So yeah. We hope that you enjoyed this and you took something away from it, and hopefully you've got some new listening to do after this episode.
Right. If you did like this format of this kind of deeper analysis on only one specific piece, then just let us know on any of the platforms that we mentioned in the outro. You'll hear those in just a second. And
if you have any submissions or any feedback for us, be sure to reach out to us on our social media platforms as well.
Right. So with that, I think we're all done. This has been an episode all about Georges Bizet's Roma, and we hope you enjoy it, and hopefully you'll take a listen to the whole thing.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Leading Tone Podcast. You can email us at theleadingtonepodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can find us on social media at The Leading Tone Podcast with no spaces on Instagram, and The Leading Tone Podcast on Facebook.
Thanks again, and tune in next Monday for more of The Leading Tone Podcast.